time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Ben Burkett. Ben Burkett is a fourth-generation Mississippi farmer, a member of the Indian Springs Farmers Association in Petal, Mississippi, leader of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, and he serves on the Food Sovereignty Commission of La Via Campesina, the International Movement of Peasants. Ben, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be here.
So let's start out. You are a fourth-generation farmer. Did you always want to be a farmer?
No, I did not. I graduated from Alcorn State University in 1973. At that time, my generation all was going to Chicago. So my intention was to go to Chicago. My father got sick that year. My mother asked me to come home to... We were growing cotton at the time. And I harvest that one crop, and I could go over either to the Army or to Chicago. I came home, harvest that crop. It fooled me. I made plenty of money. I said, I like this farming pretty good. I stay in it. So that's how I started off farming. And ever since, I've been there ever since. I've been full-time farming ever since then. Although the money didn't last that long, probably made money for 3 or 4 more years. Cotton prices went to 25 cents a pound. So then I went to soybean, wheat, corn, vegetable. I always had a true family farm. We had livestock. We had chicken. We had hog. We grew crops. We had timber, so it was a diversified farm, as it is today.
And how did your family get into farming originally?
I did a little research on that. My mother's grandfather, which had been my great-grandfather, in that area of South Mississippi, the Treaty of 1882, the Indians ceded the land to the United States government. And my great-grandfather and a few other African-Americans in that area was fortunate enough to get a homestead, 164 acres, granted to them. And I have my original documents signed by President Grover Cleveland himself, giving 164 acres to my great-great-grandfather. So that's how we got in that area. My understanding that that land was Native Americans up into that time, and that one, but a few years after slavery, so I'm still trying to see how were they able to do the right documentation, to fill out the forms and everything, to get them to Washington, D.C., to get a homestead. But that's how, now the farm is 300 acres.
All right, so I have to imagine since you began farming that things have changed dramatically. Talk about that, and maybe start out with the notion of where do you get your seeds? Have you always gotten your seeds from the same place?
That is one of the biggest concerns I have of today's agriculture. I grow mostly vegetable crops now. And the people that we grow for, such as food service companies, I'm a member of the Spring Co-op, and we are a vendor for Whole Foods. We grow for Whole Foods. So, stores, except Whole Foods, all the others require us to grow certain variety. We have to plant the seed that they want in order to sell them yellow squash, zucchini squash, or bell pepper. Even in Boston, New York, I say up in the north, they all like seedless watermelon. So we have to grow a certain type of seedless watermelon. But in the south, people still on seeded watermelon. So we have to buy seeds from Pacific companies to meet our market. On the other hand, in the row cropping, in the soybeans, corn, wheat, cotton, all of those seeds are 95 to 97% genetic engineered seed. So I wanted to plant some soybean this year, and I did plant a few because I'm going to increase my soybean production. I had to search all over Mississippi and Arkansas to find open pilot, regular hybrid seed. I didn't want to grow Monsanto or Senex genetic engineered seed, so I had to search all over the Mississippi Delta to find a few bags of open pollinated regular hybrid soybean seed. So the seed industry is being concentrated and controlled by one or two companies, not only in the United States, but in the whole world. You know, take cotton, for instance. Monsanto probably control over 60% of the cotton seeds in the whole world, not just in the United States. So I don't think that's a dangerous pattern. Definitely, having a patent or a right on a seed as a, your seed, I totally disagree with that. So it's very hard to find regular seeds. And I still try to grow some of the old-timey, sweet potatoes, old-time corn, old-time okra that is suited for South Mississippi. And it's only a few of us farmers still doing that. Now, we want to keep those seeds alive because with the advent of farmer markets, we can sell a lot of heirloom products now. And we go participate in the farmer market in New Orleans, Jackson. We even go as far away as Chicago 3 times a year with produce.
So there is demand for the heirloom products.
Absolutely. When we go, we send an 18-wheeler to Chicago for 4th of July in the wintertime before Thanksgiving. And on the west side, they have this big thing. Everybody from Mississippi had one big celebration in Chicago. And everybody in Chicago got some connection to Mississippi. And they look forward to our truck coming with traditional pink-eyed, black-eyed Crowder peas and old-time Stone Mountain and Cobb Jim Jubilee watermelons, and go on and on. Sweet potato, we still go Rico Blanco and old Puerto Rican red sweet potatoes. But you know, in the commercial marketplace and selling to Kroger's and Safeways, they're not necessarily looking for taste or quality. They're just looking for it to look good on the outside. And I think that's totally wrong. But we still try to bring back the other old varieties, and we keep them growing. One in Pacific we did this year, our old type of okra we grow, production went down to 2 acres in our cooperative. So our goal to get it back up to 10 acres. So this year we got it up to almost 5 acres. And that's a good seller, one that Whole Food worked with us on. So it picked it up real good. But to talk about the current situation of farming in this country, you got these huge conglomerate farms controlling the production of food almost. Until the last 10 years, I would say. Maybe less than 10 years with the advent of people, the consumer wanting to know where their food come from. And it's all over the country. In my South Mississippi, this year, every little town, every little crossroad wanted a farmer's market. But it wasn't enough farmers to go around, because all of them out of business just about. But everybody on a farmer's market, which is good. And we have people want to know where their food come from, which is very good. Buy fresh, buy local movement. The diet, the diet, don't eat anything less than 100 miles from your home. All these are good for small farmers. In the vegetable producing, everybody on the other hand, in the commercial crops, soybean, cotton, corn, is almost to the point where you have to have at least 2,000 acres in your small farm. I'm looking at a newspaper ad. I mean, the Jackson, Mississippi newspaper came about 2 months ago, came out with a whole section on farming in Mississippi. It was a farm in the Delta. Said it was a small farm, 10,000 acres, cotton farm. He was complaining about he can't make no money. And I was reading the article, I said, if that's a small farm, 300 acres is just, I guess I'm a hobby farmer now. So, you know, we need to rethink the farm bill in relationship of why we want a farm bill, what it would want to relate to other than this cheap food. The whole farm bill is based upon keeping food extremely cheap to the American consumer at the sacrifice of what or whom. So we really, really need to work on that. And we did some great things in the 2007 farm bill by working together. But we already having meetings now on the 2012 farm bill. That's how we can get more farmers, increase the number of farms, make it more profitable so that the next generation want to farm. That's our biggest problem in my co-op. We got 35 members, and I'm one of the youngest, and I'm almost 60. So, you know, we got a problem attracting the young people to the business. And it can make a living. I'm a living example that you can make a living out of it. And you don't have to work too hard with all this modern technology. Now, my daughter started telling me I need laptop computers and I need satellite imaging and GPS on my tractors and everything. So the technology is there, and we're doing a lot of, we call them high time, where we can extend our growing season in South Mississippi. Although we have about 8.5 months frost free anyway. But we have a number of farmers putting in high tons for specialty crops, you know, high end crops where we can carry our market all the way through, specifically farmers market and restaurants that we sell to in New Orleans. But all, I think opportunity to be here in Seattle to talk about how we can work together from Seattle to New York, New York to Mississippi, Mississippi to Texas, Texas to Florida. Not only the farmers, but farmers, consumers, educators, where we can educate the public about their food system, food and fiber system. And in my case, too, I do have 100 acres of, should I say, I had 100 acres of old growth southern pine timber before Katrina came through. Katrina harvested about 60% of it. But I'm letting it regenerate natural, so it'll take 50 years. But it's not much of that type of timber still left in South Mississippi. It's a real good, it's the type of timber there when, before America was America. It's real valuable timber, but it's slow growing. But that's the way farming is. One generation build on the next generation.
So you are going to be speaking both today and tomorrow, but tomorrow you're going to be talking specifically about the farm bill. Talk a bit more about how the farm bill impacts you and what you would like to see instituted, what changes you'd like to see instituted in the next farm bill.
Well, to say a few words about the 2007 or 8 farm bill, we had a coalition of hundreds of organizations working on the 2007 farm bill. We hope to reactivate that coalition this time, which make up religious organizations, consumer organizations, justice organizations, sustainable agriculture organizations, and a few traditional farm organizations, to put things in the farm bill that relates to conservation, sustainable agriculture, getting the school to purchase local fresh fruits and vegetables, more money for small farm direct loans for farmers that want to begin a new farmers program. This whole thing about subsidies, I'm in the middle on that, where we should cut the subsidies to the cotton farmers and the traditional farmers, and I'm reading why I say that. Within our organization, the Federation Southern Cooperative, we had a number of cotton farmers, and we surveyed all our members, a scientific survey of 10% of the one that grow cotton and receive substance. And not a one was in favor of cutting subsidies for cotton farmers. And we really researched that, and we wonder why they would say that. And we found that those farmers had better education, they had higher assets, and they were stronger farmers. So they depend upon that little bit of extra money, and it wasn't that as much as people think it is, going to the family farmer. Now, you have some huge farms in Mississippi and Arkansas. I talk about the South, because that's what I know to talk about, that receive $400,000 to $500,000, $1 million. But most of the farms we're talking about only receiving about $40,000 to $50,000 in subsidies, and that sustained the operation. I do like to see a shift from USDA, from emphasis on so much of commercial agricultural row crop, and look at changing the food system that we have in this country. I grow vegetables in South Mississippi, but my biggest competition is farmers in California. So for a box of kale, if I'm trying to sell it in New Orleans, they base what they're going to pay me up on how much it costs them to get it from California. They're going to pay me 80% of what that box cost me to get it from California. And then, you know, to move produce all the way from California to Mississippi, even back to New York, is not sustainable, you know, when we could grow it local. You know. But as they said, I can't supply them year-round. The best I can do in kale is, what, 15 weeks. Well, they want to buy it from the same farm, same person, 52 weeks out of the year. They can do that in kale. I can't do that in South Mississippi. So we have to re-educate the whole consumer in the supermarkets and the buyers, produce buyers. They're buying season, you know. Eat what's local. And Walmart is the biggest player, I think, now in the produce buying industry. We've been in some meeting with them, but they tend not to pay too well and take them too long to pay you. So with the work we're beginning now to work on the 2012 Farm Bill, and I guess the part of me being here to start that process of communicating between organizations, as president of the National Family Farm Coalition, which is a not only a national but an international organization, with our relationship with LaViva Cappuccino, which I'm a member of the Food Sovereign Commission. We're looking at it not just the United States, but food production all over the world, and how we can work together as small farmers. And the LaViva Cappuccino is a huge movement. Millions of farmers throughout the world. But we have to look at what we do here is impacted somewhere else. You know. I had a group of farmers from Africa. They were visiting with us on the exchange, and they was cotton farmers. And we visited the Delta Council office in Greenwood, Mississippi, which is a, I always just said, the blue blood farmers of Mississippi, the big cotton farmers. And we had a meeting in their office, and the executive director of that council, he said, y'all need to do in your country like we do in our country. And they said, what is that? Get your government to subsidize your farmers that grow cotton. He was very knowledgeable, the executive director, though. What they were saying, that our farmers, when we grow too much cotton, well, that puts the pressure on other parts of the world. They cotton get cheap, and that puts those farmers out of business. Everybody in the world can't farm like farmers in the United States with mechanized equipment. One man now, two people now can farm 2,000 acres of land off cotton. You don't need but two. So everybody can. If everybody in the world were doing that, we'd put so many people out of work. be so many people going to the cities with no work, it'll never work. So we need to try to keep people in place by letting small farmers grow on small acres, traditional way, without the use of pesticides and chemicals. And I know how farming, I know how to farm sustainable. But when I went to Land Grant University, up until that time, my family wasn't using no type of herbicide and insecticide. But I went to the Land Grant University. They told me to go back and tell my father he needed to use Treflan. And at that time, DDT. So I'm the one that took it back to my father. You know, up in that time, they were growing cotton fairly well without it. But no, I was taught that was progress. But in the end, I realized that wasn't too much progress. You know, we're talking about sustainable agriculture and going back, organic farming. It's really not new. We're just going back to what we were doing up into the early 70s. Because, as I said, I thought I had a degree in agriculture and I can come back and teach my mother and father something, but they knew all the time what was best.
So, touch a bit more on the issue of food sovereignty, which you work on, as well as, we only have about 5 minutes left, you are going to be speaking this evening about the ties between small farmers in the U.S. and small farmers in Africa. Can you talk about that briefly?
Okay, then. As a member of the Federation Southern Cooperative, I had the opportunity, I think the first time I traveled to the continent of Africa was 1992 to Ghana on exchange. Since that time, I think I've been, I lost count after 30 that I've been to different countries in Africa. We have a working relationship with the farmers in Senegal, Gambia, and Zimbabwe, which has been going on for well over 10 years. So I visit these farmers, and we sit and talk. I stay at their home. A number of those farmers have come visit my farm, and I look at the way they farm, as I first stated, well, the way we was farming in the South in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. You had a number of small farmers. They would produce whatever the crop was. They would bring it to a centralized place, aggregated and send it off to the market, which I thought that was a beautiful system. The research and things today say that is not the most efficient way to produce crop. The most efficient way is to have one farmer growing 100,000 acres of broccoli. I don't think that's sustainable. I don't even think that's the most efficient way, because you had 1,000 farmers growing, you have more of a community, more relationship to the land. So we, as part of the Food Sovereign Commission of La Viva Campesina, we've been looking at the control of seed, the control of the marketplace by multinational corporations. You have these huge companies that control export, import, and as you first stated earlier, I believe they're in partnership with the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to lend money to these third world countries, if there's any such thing as a third world country. I was in Central America, and they said they measure their progress by the state of Mississippi. So we were a third world country, I guess, Mississippi itself. What we're trying to do is have more people in production, more people making a living from sustainable agriculture throughout the world. And Africa is one of the continents that we have a relationship with. And we learn a lot, too, when I go to visit to those farmers. It's not a thing of where I'm going to try to tell them what to do. Well, mostly I'm going to learn something that I can bring back to my association farmers in the state, that the way we are moving products from sheep from New Zealand to the United States, when we can grow all the sheep we won't need in the United States. Mississippi is a state that used to have enough dairies to support Mississippi. Now we bringing milk from Texas to Mississippi. We don't even have enough milk production to sustain Mississippi. But we say it's more efficient to have three or four dairies in Texas milking 2,000 head than to have a family farm in Macomb, Mississippi, with 90 head of dairy cow. So that was one of the biggest thing we, as members of Aviva Cappuccino, that we worked together on, and fair price, when three or four years ago, food prices went through the roof in the world, and that had a big impact on other countries. Most countries do not have a food reserve. We have very little in the United States, so we believe if a country would grow what they grow best, have a reserve so they can moderate the prices. We won't have these high spikes and up and down. At this very moment, wheat prices just went through the roof. That's going to have an impact on farmers, consumers everywhere. And how you stabilize those things, I really don't know. We've been in meeting with several professors from the University of Tennessee, Cornell, and all these great ag schools, but sometime after wondering about these great minds, these professors and their theories, and, you know, most of the problem that's being solved come from people that with the problem, not so much from all this research and studies and demos and to commend the Gates Foundation for the effort they're doing in Africa. And but really, really, in reality, who is going to help? Is it going to help the small farmer? Is it going to help companies in the United States sell more products to those farmers? So I have learned over the last 30 years, most thing that really helps somebody is what they do local, what they want to do. And they know how to help themselves better than anybody else in the world. You can throw money at a problem, and I have seen this in the Mississippi Delta, where all these great foundations been doing development work in the Mississippi Delta. I've been keeping up with it since 1968. The poverty is still there. The education is still low. The unemployment is high. And you would think after 40 years of development work, things would change. But it's never going to change until the one that's being affected is given the authority to move their own way.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, sir.